The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, let's see, that doesn't seem to be loud enough. Can we have it a little bit louder? Let's see, is that loud enough, everyone? Everyone? I have to speak in order to know. Okay. So this morning I want to talk about faith, the topic of faith in our practice. And the word faith for some people is a very welcomed word. It evokes a sense of heartfeltness or emotional warmth. Other people, the word faith is troublesome, is frightening. They're maybe ready to run away when they hear the idea is going to be talked about. The word faith sometimes has associations of belief, and that in religions, that with religious tradition, you're supposed to believe creeds even if you don't believe them. And so it's kind of filled with conflict, the idea of faith. In Buddhism, whatever the ancient word is that's translated as faith, and I'll talk a little bit about that, it's possible that faith is not the best translation. So remember, the Buddha didn't know English. So, he never used the word faith, and so it might not be a fair word to apply to him. But, or it has to be a word we have to use carefully, trying to figure out what he might have infused the word with. The first thing to consider is that that which he kind of talked about, which is closely associated with the word faith and often translated as faith, is a faculty, meaning that it's a capacity we have, just like we have a capacity for confidence, or we have a capacity for, you know, personal strength, or the capacity for feeling stable and concentrated. So it's a kind of a psychological, maybe even psychophysical faculty we have of how we can show up, how we can act, how we can be. And rather than first and foremost, it's a belief system that we're supposed to believe in. It's a faculty we can develop. In fact, sometimes the Buddha talks about the faculty of faith becoming a strength, a personal strength that we have, we carry with us. And it's possible the word confidence gives a much more of that sense of a faculty than what the English word faith provides. I like the English word faith myself, and to me it kind of has a heartwarming quality to it, or what I associate in myself about my Buddhist faith is a heartwarming quality to it, and I find it very satisfying, the idea of faith. For English speakers, it's a little bit interesting to know that the original kind of English usage of the word faith didn't mean a belief that you, or creed that you believed, but rather it meant what you loved. Back in the Middle Ages, the word faith, not just in English, but in other European languages, was used in a context where there was only one belief that everyone, like having faith in God, there was no question that people, whether or not people believed in God, everyone kind of believed in God back in the Middle Ages. It was inconceivable, seemingly, in Europe at least, to believe anything else. It was just built into the fabric of the culture and society. But the faith that people had was the love they had for God or for that which was ultimate. So again, here we're talking about a faculty connected to love. And this idea that faith is something we love, or if you don't like the word love, another option is to say that that which you'll do wholeheartedly, that which you will give your heart over to do, that which is heartfelt, that which, you know, what your heart rests on. What does your heart rest on? And so the idea of what you'll do wholeheartedly is important in Buddhism, because in Buddhism the common word for faith, the word sadha, is meant to be a call to action. It's not meant to be so much a belief, but rather it's what gives confidence or inspires people to action, to a particular kind of action, and the action that's most important for the Buddha was the movement towards liberation, towards freedom, towards awakening. And that we usually don't become awakened just sitting, surfing the internet, or, you know, sitting on our couch or something. It does take a certain kind of action, certain kind of engagement, certain kind of giving ourselves over wholeheartedly to doing the practice. And so what is it that inspires us to do that? And whatever that is, whatever motivates us, is what the Buddha called faith. Wait until the train stops. And then we'll act. Great. We catch our breath. And so I have a lot of faith in just sitting here and doing nothing, almost nothing, except being present. And so that was delightful for me. So so we have, so the way the most common way that the word sadha, translated as English as faith, is used in the suttas, in the ancient Buddhist language, is when someone first encounters the Dharma, the practice of liberation, meditation, mindfulness, concentration, these things the Buddha taught, and something about it touches them, moves them enough, inspires them enough to try it out, to act, to start meditating, to learn more, to start following some of the pieces of the path the Buddha taught, like being ethical. And initially, you know, you have to, we say things, we take it on faith, meaning we take it without really knowing whether it's true or whether it really works, but we're going to give it a try. Interestingly, what the Buddha said, that one of the ways to get to that faith is to check the teacher out carefully. So you don't just kind of do it blindly. And in fact, the Buddha sometimes talked about you should hang out with a teacher for a long time to really see if the teacher is free of greed, free of hatred, and free of delusion. And when you're assured that that's the case, only then is it appropriate to have faith in what that person has to teach, because somehow they represent what they're going to teach, or what they're going to teach is not going to be skewed or influenced by greed, hate, and delusion. And so it's up to the practitioner to check the person out. So you're not supposed to kind of blind allegiance to a person. Now, to find someone in this world who is completely free of greed, hate, and delusion, you know, you probably can do that, but you know, I don't know that many people. You have to kind of go around and check it out for a while. So I think what you do is you do the best you can. You find what someone you feel has a degree of ethical integrity, has a degree, enough of a degree of freedom from greed, hate, and delusion, that it's worth, you know, hearing what they have to say. For some people, the person that presents this is the Buddha himself. And even though you don't meet the Buddha, people read the suttas and check him out that way and give him the benefit of the doubt, and so then listen to what he has to say. So the idea of kind of, you're looking to verify something for yourself in the Dharma. And it begins by checking out the sources in which you get it from. And then when you feel enough confidence, enough example, you feel inspired by the person who's teaching enough, that something about them kind of speaks to you, then we engage in the practice with some confidence or some trust or just enough faith that we're willing to try it out. That faith is supposed to become, with time, transformed into another quality. And some translators, it's a word, it's a quality that's related to faith, and some translators use the word confidence for this new concept. And the Pali word is pasada. And there's a particular form of pasada that's called avecha pasada, which sometimes is understood to be verified faith, or verified confidence, or confidence based on one's own knowledge. And as we practice, we get results of some kind. Something happens as we practice, as we engage in the Dharma, and we know for ourselves, oh, this works. If you decide not to yell at your boss because you're angry, and you think, instead of yelling and being angry, I think what I'll do is I'll go and sit down and breathe mindfully and calm down, and then go find a way to talk to my boss in a more calm way without the anger. And it turns out the boss then is pretty receptive to that. Last time you yelled at the boss and that didn't work. So, wow, this works. To not be caught up in my passion of my anger, but to come from another place. That's a simple thing to learn. And someone might say, well, this worked better. I know now. Next time I'm going to get angry with someone, let me try this other process. Someone starts to meditate, and they discover that in meditation, they get calmer than maybe they've ever been in before. It settles a lot of the tensions of a day. They're more settled. They're less caught up in their mental preoccupations, and that itself feels so good to do that. Some people have no idea I can feel so good and so integrated, so harmonious, so peaceful. But maybe for some people, more importantly, when I leave my meditation in this calm state, I seem to manage and be wiser how I make it through my life. So through one's own experience, one has a result, and that result verifies that this is useful and valuable. One has a lot of greed, you know, really wants something, craves something, and somehow is able to look at the mind, the heart, find out where the clutching is, and to release it and relax. And lo and behold, we're not kind of held in the grip of this clutching, this strong compulsion. Wow, I let go, and I felt freer. That's a verified form of knowledge. I know something now. So these kinds of examples points to the kind of thing that the Buddhist practice is bringing us to. It's not a verified knowledge about cosmology or rebirth or, you know, the nature of consciousness or the true aspects of reality, but rather it's a very practical understanding of our psychology and how we work. And what kind of actions, what kind of activities, what we can do that can make a difference. And it's quite powerful for people to have an experience of a mind or heart which is radically free, for temporarily at least, radically at peace without a sense of being in conflict or in turmoil or caught up in anger or delusion or greed or attachment. A heart which is settled and peaceful in itself. To know that for oneself is to verify that that's possible. And to know that that's possible can give confidence. So that's a second kind of faith that the Buddha talked about, this pasada, this verified faith, verified knowing, that then provides tremendous confidence. Bhikkhubodhi, one of the English translators of the suttas, he translates the word faith-based or confidence-based on knowledge. He translates it as unshakable faith, unshakable confidence. It's the word unshakable. Pretty, to have it so deeply understood, so deeply experienced, that now one knows something in an unshakable way, no doubt about it, and it becomes a source of strength, it becomes a source of possibility, it becomes a source of new values to live by. Because now we know a quality, know a purity or a higher quality of heart or mind that seems so important, so much goodness flows from it, that it becomes a motivating force, becomes something that we organize our life around, orient our life around. Which leads to the third kind of word the Buddha used that's associated with the word, English word, faith. And this is usually translated into English by the word refuge. And this is probably one of the idea of going for refuge, taking refuge, is one of the most central kind of religious rituals or religious movements of Buddhists. And they'll often do it as a ritual and ceremonies, a refuge ceremony. And the word refuge means to rely on something. It really is to go someplace that's safe. It's to receive protection from something. So that's nice, to feel protected by the Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha, by this practice. But some people feel this idea of refuge is a little bit too passive. The idea of refuge is a little bit like, now you're a refugee, now you're just kind of relying on something, you're dependent on something, and you're relying on something outside of yourself, and you can just kind of rest or not be engaged. But the Theravada tradition understands refuge to have three meanings. One is that one knows something, this verified knowledge. One knows something for oneself. And it's something we know that we want to orient our life around or center our life around, a value, an experience, a way of being. And we know it for ourselves. This is really, you know, I take refuge in this experience, this way of being, this orientation. Second thing it means is it does mean a motivation. It's what we aspire to, what kind of motivate us. My motivation is to live by that which the refuges represent. So the refuges are usually considered to be three, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha is the Buddha. The Dharma is usually considered to be his teaching. And the Sangha are those people who have witnessed the truth of what the Buddha had to teach, experienced for themselves. And so to be take refuge in those people and those things is nice, to know that that's possible and to have the examples of these things. But it's really meant to represent something, to be a mirror for what's in ourselves. And many things in Buddhism are meant to be mirrors of yourself. The Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi in Japan, in San Francisco many years ago, was asked, what do you bow to when you bow to the Buddha? And he said, oh, we bow to ourselves. And I think one way of understanding him saying that is that these statues, these Buddhas, are, you know, it's kind of an idealized image, symbolic image. But there's something about these images that they're supposed to represent something of ourselves. You're not expected to look like that image, but maybe you can feel like that image. You can sit and kind of feel the same level of confidence and strength and freedom and awakening and something. It's an internal feeling, a way of being. And so the Buddha represents our capacity to be awake, our capacity to pay attention, our capacity to be compassionate. The Dharma represents the practices that we can engage in, not the teachings. The teachings point to the practices. And we have to do the practices. As I like to say sometimes, this Buddhism stuff, it doesn't work at all. No way, it doesn't work at all unless you do it. So we have to do it. And the third is the Sangha is the connection, the connectivity, the heartfelt warmth that we feel to the circle of people for whom we practice together with and who are walking the path with us. So, three ideas of faith. There's the initial motivating faith that gets us started. So we investigate and look deeper and start practicing. There's the verified faith that when we for ourselves know something, that are confident in it. And then there's the refuge where we, you know, it's really a clear decision. This is really where my heart resides because it's my own. I've discovered it in myself. And sometimes it's nice to kind of have something external that represents that or holds that or sees that or mirrors that for us. To make it a little bit more interesting, I think, this idea of faith and refuge, we find lots of examples in the ancient literature from the time of the Buddha of people listening to the Buddha, being inspired by the Buddha, and declaring that they're going for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But that's the orientation. And they'll sometimes say, please take me as a lay follower. For the rest of my life, I now take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. So that's a kind of serious statement that they make that really moved them enough to make that statement. Nowhere in the suttas do we ever find the Buddha himself instructing people to do this. It was a custom in ancient India in the time of the Buddha and even before that for people to do this thing about taking refuge in particular religious teachers and certain religious realities. So it was already kind of a known custom that people did. And so it made sense for people to ask to do this or to say they were doing this. And people did, and the Buddha was basically silent. Sometimes he made some comments about it that seemed like he approved of it, but he never instructs anyone to do it. What he does instruct people to do in terms of refuge, he says a number of times, he says, make a refuge of yourself. Make yourself a refuge. Have yourself as your own refuge. Just before he died, make yourself your own refuge. And he also said before he died, I've made a refuge of myself. And what he didn't say, I found a refuge in myself. Some people want to kind of find something inside, some inherent good quality, something beautiful, something wonderful, something divine, to find something. They want to believe that there's something in there. Maybe there is. I hope so. But for the Buddha, what he emphasized was action. We discover these truths by how we live, not by how we hope. And you're not supposed to kind of just sit quietly and look and look and look until you find something. You're supposed to practice in such a way, live a life in such a way, that what appears, what arises, what surfaces for you is something that you can have confidence in, something you can believe in. Buddhism is an action-oriented religion. Though one of the actions, especially in meditation, is the action of no action in a particular powerful way of sitting upright and present and alert. But we make ourselves a refuge by how we live. And so we want to live such a way that we feel good about ourselves, we feel confident in ourselves, we feel that I'm the kind of person that I can rely on myself. I know how to go through the world, I know what to do when I'm angry with my boss, I know how to take care of these things. I know when I get caught up in my greed, I know what to do. When I get confused, I have the capacity inside of finding my way or stay stable and not lose my stability. I know that there's capacities of awareness inside. I know that there's capacities of love here that I can bring forth. So the Buddha said, make a refuge for yourself, of yourself. So what the Buddha instructed was not taking refuge in something external, but to find something and make something in yourself. So this has to do with the internal refuge. And then in one English translation of the suttas, I was quite inspired when I saw this. The Buddha also says, in the English at least, was make yourself a refuge for others. And so then I went and looked at the original. And the word is not refuge, but the word is make yourself safe for others. Make yourself safe for others. So that maybe that can go along. Make yourself a refuge for yourself. And maybe that's the same thing as making yourself safe for others. How we live in the world and how we relate to other people is also part of this whole enterprise of faith. Can we live in the world? Can we find a verified faith, verified way to live in the world so that we are safe, we don't cause harm, that we bring benefit to the world? That we don't just sit here and practice for ourselves, but we sit for the welfare and happiness of others as well. The Buddha put a tremendous emphasis on the value and the importance of living in a way that we support our society around us, the world around us. So what I hope this points to, what I'm talking about today, is that whatever this word faith is used within Buddhism, that it's not a taking on someone else's faith. It's not, you know, taking something you don't believe, but rather it's to make faith your own. Have it be your faith, something you believe in. So much so that if someone came along and said, that's not true, you could say, well, maybe not for you. But I've had so much experience with this over and over again. I know that this works for me. That's been verified for me. You make it your own. And you don't have to worry in Buddhism that you have to take on and believe ideas, teachings that don't work for you or seem just odd for you. Because it's not belief-centered. It's practice-centered. And it's the knowledge and experience that you get for yourself in doing the actions, doing the practice, living the life. That's where true faith comes from, this verified faith. That's where the motivation and the inspiration to take refuge, to say, yet these things, now I've experienced this enough, and that what the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha represent, in fact, make a very nice mirror for me. I like being associated with them. I like the way in which it reminds me to come back to what I already know. I like it that, you know, it kind of lets me kind of, it feeds or supports what I know so it can grow and develop. And we become very fortunate if we get a little seed, discover a seed within us of freedom, of peace, of inner purity, of wisdom, of compassion, of love, something. Different people experience it somehow differently. And we have discover a little seed, and rather than focusing on the jungle of confusion and greed that's around that little seed, we nourish that seed and grow it and develop it. And we have the faith and the confidence to take that seed and keep cultivating it and developing it until it becomes a great, big, stable, strong tree. In ancient India, the Buddha evoked the strength and stability of the sal tree. And if the Buddha lived in California, he would have maybe likened it to the redwood tree. They have small seeds compared to how big and strong and stable those redwoods are. And those redwoods last a long time. They can. So may the seed of your faith grow and develop, and may it be as strong and stable and upright as a redwood tree, and last as long, you know, as long. So I hope that for those of you who are uncomfortable with the topic of faith, hopefully that this talk didn't make you even more uncomfortable. So, do you have any comments or questions about this or anything you'd like to ask?
Do you have any recommendations of what things to do or consider if faith gets shaken or refuge, you have an issue with it or something like that?
So what happens if faith gets shaken and we have an issue with it? I think that take that seriously. Don't be discouraged by being discouraged. But rather, it probably represents something that's really useful for you to learn about yourself and what you're doing. Sometimes having faith shake, some faith should be shaken. Sometimes people put faith into things which are not really appropriate or in the wrong way. And so, you know, I evoke the idea of a teacher. So some people get shaken by teachers. I've known lots of people have been disappointed by teachers. You know, there's been a whole history of spiritual teachers, Buddhist teachers who that do unethical things, and people get pretty, I've seen people devastated by it. But perhaps it's certainly appropriate to be discouraged, but to be devastated or really shaken by it maybe represents that we relied too much on them. We gave ourselves over too much. Maybe there's too high expectation of what they could do for us and what they might represent for us. And so maybe it's a time to really look and see, how can I rely on myself more? Maybe I overdid it. And it wasn't really healthy the way I did it. Sometimes people, their faith in the practice gets discouraged when some major life issue arises. And they get, and somehow they feel like their practice is not up to it, to the challenge. And so maybe it takes some kind of reflection about what I expected from the practice, how realistic, you know, what can I realistically expect from the practice? What's a wise way of relating to huge challenges? Was I practicing enough? I've known people who have been discouraged by the practice because they ran into some major challenge in their life and they said, my practice wasn't up to the challenge. And then I asked them, do you meditate every day? Oh, no. You know, I meditate when I come to IMC, you know, every couple of weeks or something. Oh, that's nice. They hadn't built up the momentum of practice, the strength of the practice to prepare themselves for that challenge. So those are my words that come to mind in response to you. Does this address your question, or you want to ask again, or a different way?
Or? Thank you very much.
Okay. Let me pass it behind you again.
Hello. I'm curious about how to think about kind of doing and kind of inactive with, you know, kind of letting it be and just letting it arise and noticing it. I'm feeling some tension trying to triangulate between those two things.
So how to find your way between letting things be and letting them emerge, unfold, and the other one is to act and change things? Yeah. Sometimes it's appropriate to do one, and sometimes appropriate to the other. And it's your wisdom that's supposed to decide which one. And wisdom is discovered through experience, trying things out, and experience has a lot to do with failing. Meaning that, you know, we try things out. No, that didn't work. You know, trial and error, that didn't work. And so I know that's not the way to go. And another, we try it another way. Oh, this actually works. And so slowly we learn for ourselves when to try one or the other. It also depends a little bit on the circumstances. So generally, meditation is one of the places where it's really healthy to allow a lot of things just to be and let them unfold on their own. And use the capacity for awareness and attention, to especially for mindfulness meditation, to bring a lot of attention and stability to what's happening, but to let it kind of move through us without trying to fix it or change it. That's one way of practicing. Though sometimes if we do that for a while and say that we sit and meditate and we get angry a lot, and so every time we sit down we're angry, and I'm supposed to just accept it and let it move through me, great. So and again and again, and after a year of doing that, nothing changes. I think it's time to do something. it's time to kind of let go, or it's a time to investigate in a different way, or it's a time to look at what is it in my life going on that I keep getting angry. Maybe I need to change something in my life rather than just sit and meditate. So that's my answer for now. I'm not satisfied with my answer. But it's really up to you to figure that out for yourself.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Hi, I have more of a comment after what was just shared. What you shared about the looking at the second noble truth last week, I was kind of there before you shared about the second noble truth, and I found it very helpful to look at how I'm looking at what is coming in. And it helped me to take action. Mm. Tell me, kind of break down the different parts of the second noble truth in my own life and look at how I could be free to make new choices.
Great.
So thank you.
Thank you. So that inspires me to say this in answer to the question. Especially in some certain situations, like in meditation, that's clear there. It's often good to begin by not doing anything. So something happens, begin by looking into it. Be still. Don't try to fix. If you can, don't try to judge. Just be still with it and look at it. Look at it carefully until you understand it. And once you've looked at it, so two things will happen. One is that we stop. Maybe we learn how not to add the second arrows. We learn how not to be totally reactive to something. And that's quite powerful, to let something, difficulty, be there. The difficulty doesn't go away, but we're not anxious or upset by the difficulty. And then because we stop and look at it, we investigate it, sometimes we start seeing, then we discover maybe what makes sense to do. And sometimes it makes sense to do nothing, for even more nothing, except be aware. And sometimes it's appropriate to deal with the cause, deal with the conditions, something. And outside of meditation, it's often useful to begin by looking again. Look more carefully. Don't automatically act or habitually act, but don't do anything for, most situations you can probably safely go 2 seconds. at least, of not immediately splurting out what you want to say, but take, those 2 seconds to let it kind of resonate inside and see, is this really what I want to say? So, maybe we should, any last chance? Question? So I do wonder, when you're sitting here wondering, what would be a nice way to end? Last comment. And maybe something about that seed inside. Maybe, just maybe, something in you already knows what that seed is. Maybe you can't put words to it, can't articulate it, but maybe it's some intuition, some feeling. Maybe you can't put words to it. Maybe it's not just a little seed anymore, but a sprout or already a tree for you. But I'm confident all of you have a seed that can sprout and grow. And I hope that this practice of paying attention and paying attention in a careful and kind way, and giving the kind of attention that will make space and room to allow things to unfold and grow, will take these seeds of goodness that are in you, and that they can just grow and grow and grow, and you can share them with the world. Thank you.